Okay, welcome. I'd like to call the meeting of Education Finance, February 16th, to order. And we do have a number of testifiers today. I'd just like to let everyone know we have a very busy schedule. We'll allow for 10 minutes for presentation and approximately 5 minutes for question and answer. So I've been informed by staff that that will be adhered to rigidly. So I would appreciate your cooperation on that. We also have a group from Woodland Hills Academy here from Duluth. Are they here yet? Not yet. Okay. Well, we'll recognize them when they come in. Okay. We don't have a quorum, do we? No. Okay. Then we'll start with our testimony. Representative Fabian?
Mr. Chair, we also have a group of students here from Rochester. I'd like to recognize them. They were in my office earlier. They're bright young ladies who are good for our future. There's no doubt about that. Thanks for being here.
All right. Welcome to the committee. All right. We'll start with our first group, Ready 4K, Mr. Otis. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and continue.
Hi, I'm Todd Otis, president of Ready 4K. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify today. I'd like to give you just a brief history of who we are and then make a few other points, and I will be brief. Ready 4K is a 9.5-year-old organization formed in 2001 with the mission of helping improve public awareness and public policy to enable our kids to be ready for kindergarten. So the organizing concept is school readiness, and our whole focus is moving the needle of how many kids in Minnesota are ready to thrive in kindergarten from the level that they're at now, which is about 50%, to 100%. We're a 501c3 nonpartisan, bipartisan board, and we're located in St. Paul. A lot of our early work dealt with trying to enlist the business community in this issue, so we created a group called Minnesota Business for Early Learning, which in turn helped create the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, which I think you've heard from a couple of weeks ago. We believe that the business community's engagement in this is very important, but other sectors too. So we've worked with multiple sectors and multiple early childhood organizations, trying to unify the field and trying to focus on school readiness and, as I said, moving the needle on it. We are not committed to the proposition that any child birth to five should be in any particular place. That is to say, we're not saying they should be in child care or stay at home or be in Head Start. What we are saying is that wherever they are, they get a really high quality experience. And so it's up to the parents, and the parents will always be of paramount importance as to where those kids are. But I want you to be clear, our emphasis is on parent choice and quality, and then support for programs that help kids get ready for kindergarten. I want you to remember three numbers, and I'm going to come back to them at the end. 90, 16, and 1. So let's just talk about what's at stake with regard to the children. In your packets, you have our only handout, which is a graphical depiction of the brains of a child ages birth to five. To be honest with you, I'm not sure how old this particular brain is. But it's dramatically showing the difference between the normal development of a brain and one of a child who's been through severe stress. 90% of the connection of the neurons in those brains happens in the period between birth and five. So that's huge. This is a one-time window of opportunity to do it right. And once they're grown up, you can't go back to birth to five and get it right. So it's a huge opportunity and a huge urgency to do it right at that time. The way these brains grow well is through their relationship with the parents that and other grown-ups and care providers and other children that they work with. It's very interactive. I'm not a brain scientist, but the ones that I've heard have said the most important thing is that relationship and interaction like tennis, serve and return. That's what grows brains in an appropriate way, whether it's done by parents, child care providers, Head Start instructors, or whoever. So we know that it's important, we know that it's formative, and we know what works. What are the public benefits of doing this right? This is where 16 is. 90% of the brain neuron connection happens birth to five. 16 is the percentage return on investment that Art Rolnick and his colleagues at the Federal Reserve have estimated we get by investing in quality early learning with at-risk kids. So the public benefits are the economic prosperity of our state, because ultimately our economic prosperity depends on our people, on the quality of education, the quality of our workforce. I've seen a chart that Art Rolnick of the Federal Reserve formerly showed me of investment in education in Minnesota, growth in that investment from the mid-1950s until the early part of this century, and the growth in personal income per capita. It's a dramatically parallel line. So we went from maybe 27th to 30th in personal income per capita back in the 50s to 7th or 8th in the early part of this century. Now that's a dramatic depiction, and I know it's probably more complicated than that, but the point is education and economic growth go hand in hand, and this is the foundation of that education. You want to start early and start effectively, you're going to be paying returns on investment for the rest of these people's lives and for our state. So economic prosperity is ultimately what's at stake. There are other public benefits. The longitudinal studies of investment in early learning for quality programs show those kids who've had it who are at risk are much less likely to commit crime, less likely to be on public assistance, more likely to own homes, and more likely to thrive in school and be employable contributing members of society. So the public benefits are huge. And I think that it's really important as we think about public priorities that we keep in mind that the payoff to the public is very large, in addition to the payoff to the individual children themselves. So in order for us to move the needle on how ready for K people are, we need a combination of public and private engagement. Currently, about 3/4 of all money spent in this field is from private pockets. We would maintain that we need a significant infusion of new money from the public sector to particularly provide access for early childhood and quality early learning for at-risk kids. We need a lot of money, and it needs to be dedicated to quality programs. The Department of Human Services did a study about 6 years ago showing in accredited centers that in those centers where we have high quality inputs, the numbers of school ready kids in the five domains of child development was significantly better than the statewide average we have right now. Their numbers for language literacy and social emotional development were in the 70s and 80s. And so we know that with the right kind of inputs, when they are in the care of other people, we're going to get great results. It's a matter of the political will and the political priority to invest early. It's a grossly under-resourced field, and I'm not here just as an advocate saying that. About 5 years ago, the Itasca Project looked at the issue and estimated that if every child who was in the care of other people received the kind of quality early learning that they need, we would need another $1 billion in the system. Now, I realize I'm talking to a committee that's faced with a $6.2 billion deficit, so I have no illusions about what's going to happen this session, but I do want you to have a realistic sense of the order of magnitude of what needs to happen. And the payback is way more than that. The payback in the economy, the payback in the effectiveness of education, less remediation. Recent study by Wilder showed that over $100 million is spent by K-12 a year on remediation because kids weren't ready for K. So the paybacks are huge and they're lasting. So we have gathered the people in the early childhood together, and I'm just going to wrap up, with a policy agenda called Minnesota's Future. And we've given it to all of you as candidates, and we are happy to give it to you again as a vision for where we could go as a state to move the needle from 50 to 100% of the kids ready for K. We think those ingredients are viable, doable, and research-based. And so we'll give you that if you want it again, but we did give it to you during the course of the campaigns as well. And with that, I guess final point one. One is the percentage of the state budget that early childhood now gets. So the 90, the percentage of neuron connections when they're little, 16, the return on investment, and one, the percentage of the state budget that we now have for critically, arguably, the most important years in a child's development. With that, I'll try to respond to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Before we go to questions, I would like to acknowledge, I believe the group that came in is the group from Woodland Hills Academy, Duluth, is that correct? And along with Representative Fabian's group, I'd like to welcome you to the committee, and thank you for being here. Do we have any questions for Mr. Otis? Thank you, Mr. Otis,
for
your testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Now we have Mr. Holton from Minnesota Community Education Association. Welcome, Mr. Holton. And welcome, Ms. Mansky. Please state your name for the record and continue when you're ready.
My name is Karen Mansky, and I'm here representing MCEA and the early childhood programs that are school-based throughout the state.
And I am Tom Holton. I'm representing the Minnesota Community Education Association, as well as MNAFI. And in my professional life, I'm the Executive Director of Community Education for Bloomington-Richfield Schools. I also am an appointed member to the Governor's Advisory Council on Early Education Care, and Chair of the Access and Finance Committee. First of all, thanks to the committee for the opportunity to present today. I learned yesterday that our 30 minutes was allocated down to 15, so I'll try to speak fast to stay within my 10 minutes of presentation. And in addition to representing our two associations, I think I'm also here speaking on behalf of the literally millions of people that participate in community education programs across the state of Minnesota, and getting access to our public facilities, taking classes, getting prepared for kindergarten, getting involved in community service projects, and partnering in other programs, participating in other programs, services within community ed. I'm going to try to accomplish two things in my 10 minutes. One is give you a brief overview of community education and the services, which I'll call Community Education 101, and then I'll speak more specifically about community education's role in early education development towards the end. And I'll cover programs and services, the state aids and levies that support those programs, some participation data, and then most importantly, I think, some of the outcomes that are achieved by these public expenditures. And then finally, I'll cover community education's role in Minnesota's goal of having all children prepared for kindergarten in the year 2020. First of all, community education is a statewide delivery system. There's community education programming in all 340 school districts in Minnesota. For every tax dollar that's invested either at the state or local level, there's an additional $6 that's generated in grants, participation fees, donations, and other in-kind donations. We serve learners of all ages, and I'm going to go over some of these facts and Some of the people in the listening audience won't have them, but in your packet you'll see some additional facts that I won't cover for the legislators. And we think we're a fiscally efficient system. In all of community education, in the general funding category, the state contributes $473,000, and there's about $38 million or $39 million that's generated in aid at the levy, at the local levy. We serve over 900,000 adults, 1.7 million youth, and about an additional 285,000 early learners, many of those that the Todd Otis spoke of earlier. We take advantage of using publicly owned facilities, partnering with public and private partners. It has the advantage of local control because community education is governed by local school boards. And the amount of public investment for the general community ed levy is $5.42 per capita. The program components I'm going to cover today, I'll skip right over adult basic education because I understand you're going to hear a presentation about ABE later on. I'll cover adults with disabilities, a broad category of youth development, and our early learning programs for kids birth to five. Here's a listing of the adult basic education programs. I said I won't go into those in detail. Adults with Disabilities program is a program that serves, as it says, adults with disabilities to get them socially engaged and life skills to help them be integrated into the community. That program serves annually 35,000 disabled adults. It helps districts be in compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it's funded with $680,000 of aid statewide and $670,000 of levy. And that that amount of money hasn't been increased since the program was initiated. In the areas of youth development, there are over a million elementary school children involved in tutoring, arts, recreation, language, and getting academic support. There are 443,000 students that are engaged in leadership development. And there are also 112,000 children involved in before and after school-age care, which allows Minnesota parents to go to work and earn a living. And Minnesota does have the highest percentage of adults where all adults in the home are employed outside the home. We know that youth development and quality youth programming changes lives. It leads to increased academic achievement, increased school attendance, better emotional adjustment and connections to the school and community. It reduces risk-taking behaviors by students. And in Minnesota, over half of the community education levy and aid is spent in youth programming. On to early childhood education. I've broken this part of the presentation into three main areas: early childhood family education and home visiting, our early childhood developmental screening, and school readiness and family literacy. And the premise of early childhood family education, of course, is that families provide the first and most important learning environment. And parents are the first and most important teachers. And that's not only early on, but throughout children's lives. So our programming is built on that premise. The early childhood family education program has universal access, again, being provided in all school districts. In 2009, over 162,000 parents, again, it's a parent education program, so parents can be most effective with their children in their home and in the community, and 128,000 approximately children that participate. Of those children, there is a sliding fee scale, and that sliding fee scale allows all children to participate regardless of need. In 2008, 21% of the families in the program earned $30,000 or less, and 9% of them, their primary language was not English. It's also a referral system. 2008, 19,000 referrals to other human service, medical, Head Start, and adult basic education systems. And the state investment in that, about 21 $1 million in aid and 22 local matching levy for that program. Early childhood developmental screening is all Minnesota children are screened prior to starting kindergarten. Purpose of that screening is to identify learning delays or physical problems to get them on track to be ready for kindergarten. And again, families are referred to other educational programming, community service providers, social service, and to get the medical help to get them on track. And that's done for a cost of about 30, it's actually funded about $30 to $75 per student. And the data would show that that doesn't cover the cost across Minnesota. And the state aid to cover that program is $3.4 million. School readiness, the public option in schools for getting kids ready for kindergarten is a voluntary public school program for 3- and 4-year-olds. It targets low-income families. The purpose is to accelerate school readiness skills. It has parent involvement as a key component. There's a sliding fee, and 50% of the families in that program pay no fee at all. It's offered in all 340 school districts in Minnesota, annually serves 32,500 students, 26,000 parents, and then an additional 7,719 children with special ed that are integrated into our school readiness program in school districts. Our state, as you know, has a goal to have all children kindergarten ready in 2020. To reach that goal, we think Minnesota needs to provide additional and continue high-quality early readiness opportunities. We know that about 50% of our students are not ready, and we know that the research says these same students are the ones that are most likely not to reach that critical milestone of reading at grade level by third grade. And that program has been funded at the same level since 1991. And Art Rolnick was already quoted as the importance of investing in early ed, so I'll skip over that. In your packet, you'll see there Minnesota goes by 10 essential elements of quality in early education, and you'll see if you go through those and look at our Minnesota reports that school readiness programs meet all of those 10 essential elements. I want to go on to close my presentation with some effects and a local story about school readiness. In 2004 in Bloomington, we got an early reading first grant to develop best practices in school readiness. And we took a good program and made it into a model program with some federal funding. And our first cohort of students consisted of 94-year-olds. 86% were English language learners, 98% free and reduced lunch, 86 both. Those of you that know the demographics, those are the most kids likely not to succeed in school. I'd like to bring attention to the first two columns, MCA2 reading grade 3, MCA2 math grade 3. If you look at those columns, in Bloomington, last year when our third graders took their MCA2s, that first graduating class from our early reading first, our district reading total passing was 81%. Our first ERF, early reading first cohort, who are the most disadvantaged kids, the most likely to succeed, passed at a 78% rate. A like cohort of kids that didn't have that intervention had a 51% passage rate. And that's not only a small incremental improvement, that's a major improvement. And you'll see the same sort of results in the math proficiencies that took place. We've replicated that program and on fewer dollars, and we're getting the same results as you see our 2009 kindergarten assessment. You'll look at our Kinder Prep, which is a replication of that program, and our Kinder Prep Plus, which is one additional day. We are meeting and exceeding our average Bloomington entrance requirements for those kids that have the opportunity to participate in that program. Art Reynolds and Never mind. One of our local researchers at the University of Minnesota who sits on the Governor's Advisory Council says the greatest investment we could make in Minnesota of reaching that goal of all kids ready by 2020 would be invest more money in a publicly funded 3- and 4-year-old preschool program. So with that, I know I've exceeded my time by 2 minutes, and thank you for the opportunity.
Mr. Holden, Ms. Manske, I appreciate it. I understand you thought you had 30 minutes, and respect all other groups. I appreciate you putting it in 10. Do we have questions from the committee? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to make sense here. I was just taking notes along the way of your presentation, and thank you very much. It was very informative. I'll just go to one of the ones I was struck by. Obviously, community ed kind of spans a wide variety of services that you provide in communities for adults down through the early learners. And in your figures, it looks like you have roughly double the amount of youth and early learners than adults serviced. And you said that over half of your levy and aid is spent in youth programs, but I'm wondering, is there a formula component that the state provides for your programs, or how much flexibility do you have in how you allocate resources for your programs?
Mr. Holden.
I would have to give another community ed financing 101. As with other state financing, it's complicated. There's a general amount of money that's general community education that can be spent based at the needs at the local level across all program areas. There's some of that that's designated for youth. And then the other major program components, adult-based basic education, early childhood family education, and school readiness all have designated levy and aid formulas of dollars that need to be spent in that area. So the 595 is local control, and the other categorical funds must be spent within those particular areas.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And if I could follow up just on a question on Mr. Chair, Mr. Holton or Ms. Manske, I noted that in early childhood, which I'm particularly interested in, a number of your families that are served are, fairly low income in that, and then obviously you charge sliding scale fees. Do you have a number of upper income families that also participate, and are you able to sort of help keep your program going or facilitate it a little more with the fees on those higher income participants?
I think a good example of that, as you saw that program we replicated in school readiness in Bloomington, I'll use that as an example. Our school readiness allocation per student for our 3- and 4-year-olds in Bloomington, if you divide it amongst the number of students we have, is under $90 a student per year. It costs somewhere between $8,000 and $16,000, national estimates, to provide a high quality education program in a school system. And so the answer is yes, we do charge fees to those that can pay, and I refer to it in our district as Robin Hooding. We have that flexibility to charge those that can pay, and then we reallocate those resources and distribute to those that can't. So community education does an awful lot of that, as well as bring in outside funding sources to supplement what the state provides.
Thank you. One final question, Mr. Chairman. How do you all assess quality of your early childhood programs from community to community, and what kind of a network have you all established to kind of measure those things and compare yourselves?
Mr. Holton.
Each one of the each district has to submit a biannual plan for early education, and in that plan they have to identify a number of elements of quality, all built on those 10 essential elements. Most districts participate in work sampling, which measures the results. It also is an informative assessment that helps programs and instructors raise a level of quality. So there are a lot of checks and balances, as well as quality things that are done. MNAFI, which is a professional association dedicated just to early childhood professionals, that have conferences. The Minnesota Community Education has conferences. other early care providers at conferences, and the one unique feature of all early childhood family ed and school readiness programs is all teachers are required to be licensed by the state of Minnesota with a licensure in early education development.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony today. Okay, we'll continue on with a presentation by Head Start Association, Ms. Kelly, Ms. Gilkey, and Mr. Carver. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and continue with the presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gail Kelly. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Head Start Association, and I reside in Duluth.
I'm Laura Gilkey, and I'm the Head Start Director for the Scott Carver Dakota CAP Agency, and I'm the Head Start Director.
I'd like to begin by giving kind of Head Start 101 overview here as well. The Minnesota Head Start Association represents Head Start programs across Minnesota. And today, I'll be referring to Head Start and Early Head Start collectively as Head Start, just to be a little bit easier. Currently, we have 35 federally funded grantees in Minnesota. They include community action agencies, standalone nonprofits, a school district, and seven tribal governments. Last year, those grantees wrote federal grants to bring to their local service areas $88.4 million in services for early learning and family development. In 2010, that constituted about 11,800 slots for children most at need in Minnesota. Minnesota also capitalizes on that existing early learning foundation to provide about $20.1 million in state grants that serve an additional 2,500 high-risk infants and toddlers and preschoolers. Last year, about 900 additional children were added to the program thanks to some federal American Recovery and Reinvestment funding. And we expect that funding to sunset on September 28th of 2011. So all told, Minnesota Head Start serves approximately 15,300 high-risk infants and toddlers and their families. And I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you that Head Start's not an entitlement program. We can only serve the number of families that we're funded to serve. Our income eligibility is 100% of poverty. So for a family of four this year, that is less than $22,350 a year. And it's lower than the income eligibility for Medicaid, food stamps, free school meals, and most other federal programs. We serve less than the income-eligible children in our state, and that percentage is really dropping. When the child poverty rate in Minnesota went from 13.7 to 15.7 percent in 2009, the percentage of income-eligible children we could cover dropped to 28%. So a very small portion of the high-risk children in Minnesota under five. So our priority is to serve the highest risk. We have risk criteria every program uses to choose the children that will be enrolled and the families that will be enrolled. And each year we serve more children with disabilities, more homeless families, and more children with developmental delays. In 2010, 52% of our enrolled children were racially diverse, and 31% spoke a language other than English in their home. We're federally authorized, and we are required to serve the comprehensive needs of each child in the context of their family. Our federal performance standards dictate the scope of these services, and we must address children's school readiness, their social competency, their health, as well as promote the economic self-sufficiency of parents. And this translates into a very individualized plan for each child. Head Start's qualified early childhood staff put that plan into action with very intentional instruction using research-based curricula and early literacy programming. They have research-based child assessment tools they use ongoing, and they have ongoing discussions with parents. It's an open dialogue. We provided you a state fact sheet, and I'd like you to turn to the second page. As we were able to provide, we provide you evidence of the steady progress of in child development of a sample of 1,300 4- and 5-year-olds in Head Start across Minnesota. In all critical domains of learning, language, literacy, social, emotional, and physical health, the number of children reaching the highest level of skill development in each of these areas doubled or tripled from the fall to spring. And that's less than 9 months last year. Each child comes to us at different stages of development, and we have to meet them where they're at. But national studies and local program data show Head Start is helping families get children ready for school. I enclosed in your packet a fact sheet about one such national study, the Head Start Impact Study. It was mandated by Congress in 1998. While we don't have time to go into all the details of this rather large study, the authors report that Head Start children outperformed the control group in every domain they measured, including positive social, emotional, health, and parenting impacts. Head Start children left Head Start more ready for school than their peers in the control group. And I'll hope we'll have more time later to discuss how we continue these children's progress in their first years in formal education. The parents in the audience who are here today would like me also to mention that Head Start staff supports families to address their personal goals to reach self-sufficiency. I've included in your packets a story from a family in Duluth Head Start that's a real powerful testament to the partnerships that programs establish with parents. They use family goal setting and leadership opportunities and policy counsel so families find opportunities to achieve personal success, become advocates for their children, and leaders in their community, which benefits our whole society. As our state experiences economic hard times, Head Start is a very vibrant economic engine in your communities. We employ over 3,400 full-time staff positions with benefits. That's one job for every 4.5 children we serve. Between 70 and 80% of those funds go right back into salaries and benefits for people living in your local communities. The remaining funds are directly invested in the local economy, purchasing food, gas, facilities, supplies, services, and services. So in many of our small communities, Minnesota Head Start is considered a major employer. But the greatest benefit is, as you've been hearing here today, there's good evidence to suggest a direct savings to local taxpayers when they invest in high-risk children. Most conservatively, 1-7 return on the investment, coming back to us in terms of increased future earnings, employment, family stability, decreased welfare, crime rates, grade repetition, and special education. Also remember that as affordable care, our families can then be working and be productive and keep be a part of the workforce. I've asked Laura to talk about what it looks like on a local level, and I think we have a few more minutes so that we can really help you see how Head Start's locally designed and controlled so that it fits the individual needs of your local communities. So, and we'd be happy to answer questions after she comments.
Thank you. Ms. Gilkey?
Okay. Hi. Thank you. Thank you for having me today. Again, my name is Laura Gilkey, and I'm the Head Start Director for the Scott Carver and Dakota CAP Agency. We have a Head Start program there, and I wanted to just give you a little bit of a viewpoint of what that program looks like sort of on a daily basis, a little more personal view. We've heard a lot of facts and figures today, and I know that can kind of ramble on, so I just wanted to give you a little bit more of a bird's-eye view of what a typical program might look like. We serve 466 children. We, as I said, our program is for three counties, and we reach from Chaska, Minnesota, Shakopee, Rosemont, all the way to South St. Paul. We have 14 classrooms, and we have a morning program in each classroom and an afternoon program 4 days a week. So it's a very intensive program. It's a 9-month program, and the kids come 4 days a week. We have very high-quality staff that are, many are working on their credentials. Many have four-year degrees and AA degrees and early childhood degrees. We have a low child staff ratio. We have 3-1 for, 3 staff in our classrooms with 17 children. Our children generally as a whole come into our program at about 30% proficiency in cognitive, social, emotional, and physical development. And when they leave our program in the fall, they're as a whole 80 to 85% proficient in these areas. So we are preparing children for kindergarten and closing the achievement gap. A strong part of our program, as Gail mentioned, is our parent support and involvement. Parents are involved in all aspects of our program, including volunteering in our classrooms, field trips, family events, parent committees, and also, as Gail mentioned, on our policy council. We have representatives from each of our classrooms that meet monthly. They're a decision-making group for our program, and they're very, very involved. They're advocates for us, and they also are gaining strong leadership skills as they are participating in policy council. And one quick little story, just to make it a little more personal, and when we were meeting this fall with our new policy council representatives, I just wanted to share we had five parents that were helping with training and preparing these new families as they were coming to us, and these five parents all had children that were just entering the kindergarten. It was November, and they all went around the table and told us these fantastic stories of how well their children were doing in kindergarten. They were beaming. They were happy. Their kindergarten teachers were telling them how advanced their children were, how they're starting to read, and how all of those skills that they learned in Head Start was benefiting them as they were starting their school career in the K-12 system. And I think that's a powerful testimony to the high quality of our programs and how we are meeting the needs of kids and families. So thank you again for letting me testify today.
Great. Thank you. Questions from committee members? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming and testifying, driving down from Duluth. Holy smoke.
Always.
Just a couple of things I was struck by, and I've known this for a while, beginning your testimony that currently we're only reaching 28%, it sounded like, of eligible students and or families, rather, and so I was really struck by you know, the fact that two-thirds of our otherwise eligible low-income families out there are not participating. And having served on the commission on the Poverty Commission a couple of years ago, we got a pretty good over 2 years of study and reflection and visiting all over the state. We got a pretty good education on the total inadequacy of the 100% poverty level as the marker that. And as you pointed out, several programs have recognized that, and so they'll, you know, typically go to 125, 150. I think New York City just a couple of years ago adopted, I think, a 200% level of poverty, which is still really means that families are barely making it. Is the 100% mark, is that, I take it that that's a federal, right. I mean, that's by federal mandate and law. And so Mr. Chair, she's nodding. I won't have her answer that, or answer it in depth. But my question then, let me jump over to the study issue, because, you know, later on we're going to hear some testimony that we're wasting money, apparently, when it comes to programs like Head Start and some others. And that debate's been around here for a long time. And, you know, it's fair to debate, you know, our public investments. But I noticed the fact sheet that you have here on the study, one mandated by Congress. And I just want to be clear, because, you know, there's a couple of things here that I think could mislead folks to interpret the data. It looks to me like when you look at these students as they're entering into kindergarten, they have some measurable advantages relative to those who haven't. However, in a pretty short period of time, those advantages seem to fizzle out, I think is what this is. So I just want to be clear about this. And to me, that if that's true, that seems more an indictment, if you will, of our K-12 system's inability to continue with some of the practices that have been successful with these low-income families during Head Start. And yet later on in the long term, those students continue to have advantages. I assume that means advantages relative to students who never were in Head Start, however, probably still facing some challenges, perhaps based on the fact that they don't have this kind of ongoing support. So it's kind of a long question, but I just, I think there's a couple of points there I think need to be clarified.
Ms. Kelly, and unfortunately, we probably don't have as long for the answer.
I'll try to be brief. It would be fun to be able to just have a testimony on the Head Start Impact Study, because it's quite complicated, and I appreciate that you want to get to the nuances. I think let's address this fade-out issue, this myth that's there. I think Art Rolnick has indicated that cognitive scores, academic scores, have shown to drop after children leave early childhood. And one of the things that we know that we have to let them go, unfortunately. We can't control what schools they go into, what kind of education settings that they have. But we know that when they leave Head Start, they've made significant progress. And that's the study does show that unequivocally. I think the thing that's so important for us to understand is how do we continue to support the family? And that's one of the things we think is a real, really important key as children leave Head Start and move into the school district. How do we continue to support the family for their child's success? But regardless of what happens to cognitive scores, whether they lag or not, the long-term benefits have been substantiated by peer-reviewed journal articles. And I have a number of them here today, and I can drop them off if anyone wants. But it shows that at the very least, just by special education and grade retention and other things that are happening in the early years in school, we are seeing a benefit, cost benefit for Head Start. If you continue to 15 and 20 years, we're looking at lower crime rates, we're looking at that dependency going down, and the return can be even greater. So again, I appreciate the opportunity to respond to that very controversial aspect of the study, and I'd be happy to do that again in the future.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. We'll have one final question from Representative Woodard.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very quick question to make sure I understand, in particular, the Scott Carver Dakota cap numbers. There are 466 kids that are in the program, and roughly $3 million or so that is spent on the program. Is that right? I'm just looking at the funding source. Is that about right? So we're on about state average per pupil spending for the Head Start program as we are for regular education, for K through 12 education. Is that a fair statement?
Ms. Kelly or Ms. Gilkey?
Yeah. The average cost per child for Head Start is $7,300, And that includes everything. One of the difference between the school district number and this number, this includes transportation, everything. So it is a little bit lower than your per pupil cost.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And thank you for your testimony today. Okay, next up we have the Literacy Action Network. Mr. Citron Heisem. Welcome, sir, and state your name for the record and continue.
Tom Citron Heisem, Mr. Chairman, committee members, I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak with you for just a few moments about adult basic education, or ABE, in Minnesota. Adult basic education is a statewide program. Last year, we served nearly 80,000 low-skilled adults throughout the state. And we provide a menu of really essential services that help people achieve their goals in many different ways. That includes ESL, or English language instruction, for new Americans. We do a lot of work in family literacy, which I'll talk about later, just a little bit more depth, for both parents and their children. We help people who, for whatever reason, did not have high school diplomas obtain their GEDs. We help people from other countries who have moved here as legal residents obtain their citizenship. We do increasing amounts of work in helping people prepare for the workforce and in transitioning to higher education. Our services are provided throughout Minnesota by over 50 consortia in about 500 locations. And one of the things that's become apparent in meeting with some of the members of the committee that's important is that we have a very sound funding formula. We're not here asking for more money. We just want you to know that we have a very good formula that was developed about 10 years ago and that equalizes the funding in what everyone believes is a very fair way between the high population urban areas and the greater Minnesota areas where there is very high need but long distance, not as many people, but long distances between sites and other factors that make the cost of providing services per person a little bit higher. And we think we're a bargain. The total cost last year per learner was $647, which compared to the K-12, of course we're not as intensive generally as K-12, but is we feel a really good bargain. Because we are community-based, we are able to respond really very quickly to local communities and their changing needs. Two examples of this I would cite. A number of years ago when we had a arrival of unexpectedly of several thousand Hmong refugees from the Wat in, I believe, Thailand, we were able to really ramp up very quickly our ELL services to help those people begin to gain the English skills that they needed to participate in society. And in the last several years, as we have gone through an economic recession, we've had large numbers of adults who have been laid off from their jobs, but who didn't have GEDs or didn't have very advanced skills because they didn't need them in those jobs, have come to our centers around the state trying to increase their basic skills, in some cases getting their GEDs or looking towards other sorts of credentials and certificates. So we've been able to reorder our service delivery to meet those needs quite quickly. The demand for services is very high. Last year, we grew by about 8.5% in terms of total student contact hours, which is how we count our services, and about 7% in the number of students. And the reason those numbers are a little bit different is we saw the number of hours of service per student going up a little bit, which we think is a good thing because the greater intensity of services tends to lead to better outcomes. So we're pleased with that. And I want to mention that we have very good outcomes for the past 4 years. We have surpassed our federally established national reporting system goals. ABE is funded by a combination of federal and state funds, and the federal Department of Education sets goals that we have to meet each year in terms of each of our areas of service delivery. And we have surpassed those and, in fact, helped the state the last several years obtain incentive grants, WIA incentive grants, as a result of the services we provide. And then I'd just like to briefly highlight a couple of areas that I think you might be interested in. And the first one has to do with how we help deal with the achievement gap. And I think you have in your folder some information on family literacy. And we do two kinds of family literacy program in adult basic ed. The first one is a very formal type of program that involves parent literacy, parenting instruction, parent-child interaction, and then services for children. We also, however, integrate a variety of family literacy activities in all of our services. We think it's just crucial that parents understand how to support their children, how to prepare them for school, how to monitor their homework, how to communicate with their teachers effectively. And we find, for instance, with new Americans that come from other cultures and societies, they often have a very different perspective on education than we have here. So they need, in order to help their children be effective in the system here, they need to learn how to do those things. Similarly, some low-income people have not had the opportunity to learn some of the skills that are so essential in helping their children do well in school. And in support of that, there are a number of studies which are cited in the handout that you were provided. Children's literacy levels are strongly linked to the educational level of their parents, and most especially their mothers. And that's true in both the developed and the developing worlds. So we see the work that we do with parents, and especially mothers, just a key factor in helping them help their children do better. Children of parents that are unemployed and who have not completed high school are 5 times more likely to drop out than the children of employed parents. And a study of children participating in family literacy programs in 15 cities in the U.S. showed an 80% increase in reading books, and that those children made twice as many trips to the library. So we think we're having a real impact on some of the factors that will help over time attack the achievement gap in K-12. The second thing I'd like to talk a little bit about is the work that we do in partnership. Partnership and collaboration are really key to adult basic education. As part of community education, we have links to a large number of community programs. We work with nonprofits, workforce centers, community colleges, and a large number of other organizations. And by working together, we're able to leverage resources effectively to meet community needs at the local level. As those needs change, we can adapt very quickly. And then finally, I want to talk just a little bit about our work in addressing crucial skills needs. And this involves working with employers, workforce centers, community colleges, and others to develop career pathways to help learners progress to higher education and better jobs. And this involves from the very lowest level of basic skills, teaching people soft skills, what's going to be required in the workforce, what's going to be required in higher education, proceeding through their education, helping introduce them to various kinds of educational programs, and help them to meaningfully plan for the future, hopefully to get some higher education, and to obtain jobs that will allow them to earn a family-supporting wage. Helping them to better support their families really attacks poverty, which is a huge factor in the K-12 achievement gap. So we know that better jobs encourage better outcomes for our children in the public schools. So in conclusion, I'd just like to note that we believe and are very proud of the fact that ABE is a very highly effective program in Minnesota. It serves adults throughout the state. We believe we get very good results for the amount of money that's invested in the program. And I would just like to thank you for your ongoing support over the years in support of ABE.
Thank you. Mr. Citroen-Heisem, I appreciate your first statement saying that, you know, you're not coming here asking for more money, but my hunch is that you're not asking for less.
Probably not.
Just wondering, in the Governor Dayton's budget proposal, the adult basic education did get highlighted as a cut. I'm just wondering if you have any comments on that.
We have, under current statute, a 3% increase each year if our services increase by at least that amount. And last year they increased, as I mentioned, by about 8.5%. My understanding of the budget is that decrease is reduced to 2%, although as our growth around the state is remaining steady at a pretty high rate around the state. So certainly we'd like the 3%, but if we can get 2%, we would be very happy.
Thank you. Any questions from committee? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, I'm looking at this very good brochure, this current year statistics, and I'm just curious, the ABE participants, and I really did not know that one out of every 10 diplomas in Minnesota was GED or adult high school diploma.
Yes.
That is really something. But of that age range of 25 to 44, which is 54% of your participants last year, 2010, do they ever tell you, or do you ever have the opportunity to learn why it is that they didn't finish high school or may have dropped out? Or can you share that?
Sure,
I mean, I'm not looking for specific
right.
stories, but just generally speaking.
You know, we do not do formal studies. Madam Chair, committee member, sorry. We don't do formal studies of that, but we know in our discussions with adult learners that there are a number of factors. Sometimes young people have children at a young age and drop out of school. Our new Americans often come from societies where they had no opportunity because of war to engage obtain their high school diplomas. Very often, there's family breakdown. There's the need, very often in very poor families, that people have to go to work at a very young age. So they drop out of school, and you'll get some kind of a low-paying job, which doesn't really have a future, but helps solve the immediate need, although in the long term, it really puts them at a tremendous disservice. So there are really just a wide variety of factors at play, and very individual depending on the person and the family.
Mr. Chair. Representative
Erickson.
Sir, how long does it take a student to get through the program?
Representative.
Mr. Citroen-Heisem.
Thank you. You know, it really depends a great deal on the skill level of the student when they enter the program. We have a fair number of GED students who come in, and they really need just a little bit of brush up. Mm-hmm. You know, and in 15, 20 hours, they can take their GED, pass the five tests, I believe it is, mm-hmm. and get their GED. We also have people who have dropped out of school at pretty young ages, junior high, first couple of years of high school, who have maybe reading at a fourth or fifth grade level. Obviously, they're not going to be able to get their high school diploma equivalent in a very short period of time. So in those cases, it really depends on not just the skill level of the individual, but on their motivation and on their family situation, their working situation in terms of how intensively they can attend services. So it could be anywhere from a few months to, in some cases, a few years, depending on those factors. Our effort is to move people through the system as quickly as possible because we know they need to get on with their lives and on with their careers.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Greiley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment on your comment on the Governor Dayton's nicking adult basic education, changing it from 3% to 2%. And I'm a big fan of adult basic education. I bet we all are here. And I'm visiting the program in my district on Friday. And some of us did have this conversation yesterday with the Commissioner of Education, and that's the one part of Governor Dayton's budget that we don't like as well as all the other parts. So I just wanted to announce here today that when the Republican proposal comes forward on adult basic education, if it does not cut adult basic education or add to it or anything like that, I want to publicly declare that I'll be happy to vote against my governor on that issue.
So noted.
Mr. Chair, one thing I did neglect to mention earlier, that I'm here representing the Literacy Action Network, which is a statewide professional group providing professional development and advocacy around the issues of adult basic education in Minnesota. I did want to mention that for the record.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? All right. Thank you for your presentation today.
Thank you very much.
Next up, we have the Education Liberty Watch. I think before we do that, we do have a quorum, so Representative Loon, have you reviewed the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, in great detail.
Mr.
Chair, I would move adoption of the minutes from the meeting of February 15th.
Representative Loon has moved the minutes of February 15th. Any discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, those minutes are adopted. Thank you. Welcome to Ms. Ephraim from Education Liberty Watch.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Karen Ephraim. I'm a mother of three, a pediatrician, and a policy analyst for Education Liberty Watch. I'm here to give you an alternative view of some of the research in early childhood education that you've been hearing about today and for a long time, because it's really important with the economic situation being what it is and the parents and taxpayers of this state already being so economically stressed to really make decisions based on good information and complete information about the effectiveness or lack thereof of these programs. I am going to go through the PowerPoint briefly, and then I gave you another handout that contains a long list of quotes and references so that you can look at that at your leisure, and I'll be happy to answer questions at the end. Because you all are representatives of the people, I think it's really important that you understand that there is not tons and tons of popular support for these programs. And I've listed in the second slide a number of news items and budget items from 2011 back to 2006. And I wanted to mention the 2008 deadlock citizen jury because I gave a half-hour presentation very similar to this one to a group of citizens at the Humphrey Institute. And then they heard 3 days of testimony from proponents of early childhood programs, and the jury deadlocked. They didn't want these programs. 30% were for, 30% were against, and 30% didn't care. We've heard a lot about the $16 return on investment for every dollar spent on early childhood programs. Yet a study that just came out this last month said that these figures are based on the results of a small set of impressive but outdated studies. More recent literature reveals positive short-term effects for early childhood programs on children's development that weaken over time. So that brings up the issue of fade-out that Representative Mariani mentioned. I mentioned this other one about fade out from the University of California at Santa Barbara, and there are a whole bunch of other studies listed in your quote sheet. We constantly hear about brain research as the driving force for early childhood education. Yet there's a study from just a few months ago in 2010. From Dr. Jack Schoenkopf, who is Art Rolnick's favorite guru, to quote, and he said that there's still need for greater synergy. The theoretical connection hasn't yet been established. I want you to understand that. There's lots of research going on, but the practical application is still many years in the future. And a quote from Dr. Schoenkopf from 2000 in his seminal Neurons to Neighborhood study says that assertions that the die has been cast by the time the child enters school are not supported by neuroscience evidence and can create unwarranted pessimism about the potential efficacy of interventions that are initiated after the preschool years. It's not a crisis that we have to deal with in preschool. And then I list a whole bunch of other studies from experts with similar views. We keep hearing about the supposed long-term benefits of preschool, yet in states like Oklahoma and Georgia that are rated first and third, respectively, by the National Institute for Early Education Research in both access and quality, they have actually seen no improvement in the fourth grade National Assessment of Educational Progress reading scores, and in the case of Oklahoma, have actually seen a decline over the time that it was these programs became universal in those states. And if we're thinking about spending this much money, we really need to be looking at these things, because fourth grade is when the effects of preschool should be most obvious. And if they're having no effect or decline in reading scores, that's something to be concerned about. The Head Start National Impact Study that you just heard about mentions that there's lower teacher assessment of math skills of the three-year-olds in kindergarten. That's another red flag that should be raised, as well as the fact that the beneficial effects of Head Start fade by the end of first grade. And there were over 600 studies done showing no great effectiveness of Head Start back in 1997. So this is just yet another one. And in addition, the Government Accounting Office did an operation and testimony last year in Congress that had some Head Start centers across the country were fraudulently enrolling children, which is affecting the kids that really need it. So that's another thing to be aware of with Head Start. State data for Georgia showed that students enrolled in the Head Start program consistently tested below the national norm and significantly behind their peers. The legislative auditor, and I realize this is 10 years ago, but the legislative auditor hasn't found any large-scale studies of the effectiveness of Head Start in this state. And we spend $40 million per biennium on top of the 160-some that we receive, 170-some that we receive from the federal government. Poor children in Oklahoma, again, this high-access, high-quality preschool state, 80% in the 2010 National Assessment of Educational Progress fourth grade scores, 80% failed to reach proficiency. That's not a great record. New Jersey has been offering court-ordered preschool for low-income children since 1998, and yet the number of children, of poor children who are scoring below basic, meaning that they're illiterate, increased over that same period of time. The next slide lists eight different studies showing concerns about emotional and behavioral problems with children enrolled in early childhood. And I just want to quote one. It says, attendance in preschool centers, even for short periods of time each week, hinders the rate at which young children develop social skills and display the motivation to engage classroom tasks. We're wanting to screen all these kids and say that we need to do more for them when in fact the very interventions that we're doing may be causing the socio-emotional problems. I listed a number of education-related mental screening programs that we have in this state, and some questions from the Ages and Stages socio-emotional test to show you the vagueness and subjectivity of what we are screening our kids with. There's also a very high false positive rate with the Ages and Stages, so that for every 21 kids properly identified as needing more diagnosis or intervention, 73 would be falsely referred. If you did that with a medical test, physicians would be sued or they would be laughed out of existence. There has been a huge increase in overdiagnosis of bipolar disease, particularly in African American youngsters over the last several years, and that's a concern. The number of children receiving psychiatric medication is going through the roof, particularly for antipsychotics, which are very dangerous, and we need to be careful that we're not over-screening or doing things that may actually be contributing to it. Regarding screening, the Department of Education, right on their website, says that it's required for entrance, yet they fail to tell, and districts do this too, fail to tell parents that they may conscientiously object to screening, and that the districts are supposed to notify them that they do not have to participate. And we're spending quite a bit of money on this. We're spending $6 million and the governor wants to spend over $7 million. Half-day kindergarten showed when it went universal that it helped some aspects of social problems for whites, but nothing for African Americans. And then there are studies that show that it full-day kindergarten doesn't benefit low socioeconomic status students, and that there's another study that full-day kindergarten increases anxiety, loneliness, low self-esteem, and sadness, and decreases math skills at fifth grade. So if we're talking about spending $533 million on full-day kindergarten, we ought to be aware of the potential problems with that. ECFE school readiness, again, don't have tons of data to their benefit other than people like them a lot. But in these times, again, we have to be careful about how we're spending them. The kindergarten readiness assessment is another problem that it's very vague and subjective, and it really shouldn't be used to say that 50% of kids are not kindergarten ready. What really closes the achievement gap is intact families and religious involvement, parental involvement, not programs, and academic basics like phonics and traditional math. And then I end at the end with a number of recommendations, and I would be happy to discuss those in more detail, but I really thank you for the time to testify.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Ephraim. Earlier I had asked the question at the Head Start of the study that Congress had mandated and that was conducted in 2009. So I'm trying to be really objective here. So on the one hand, I have, as a policymaker, I have a study before me that says or that indicates that there's some important outcomes, positive outcomes, as a result of participation in Head Start. On the other hand, at the same hearing, I hear that there's studies that challenge those outcomes. And, of course, you do point out the legislative auditor's report from a decade ago about basically saying, you know, we haven't really assessed what our investment has been. Is it your position, then, that given the fact that we have apparently competing sets of information before us, and that this state has a decades-long involvement in investing in these kind of efforts, is it your position then, would it be your advice and recommendation that we invest some monies in actually studying what the outcomes are relative to Minnesota's investments and Minnesota outcomes?
Ms. Ephraim.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, you could spend more money in Minnesota to try and study outcomes here, but to my mind, the 600 plus studies that they've done all over the country and still haven't found great benefit of early childhood or of Head Start specifically, kind of make me think that that would be wasting money. Well, and I think what should be done instead of investing either in more early childhood programs, more money in Head Start, or more studies is to look at what really works, and that's not in early childhood. That's in doing welfare and social policy that promotes intact families and family formation, that doesn't penalize paternal involvement, that does penalize no-fault divorce, and that then works on academic basics like phonics, and demand that of every program that you do. And real traditional math, and our Minnesota standards are amongst the best in the country. So I really hope that you don't consider the idea of adopting the Common Core standards in math, because that would be disastrous for preschool all the way on up. And work that way.
If I may, because Ms. Heffron, you just covered a universe of issues here, and again, in the spirit of being objective and fair, it would seem to me, without arguing that any of those outcomes are inappropriate or inaccurate or not applicable to what our policy goals here, it seems to me that the fair thing for us, the objective thing for us to do on any of those, is in fact to measure their perceived outcomes. And I have to say, I totally respect where you're coming from on a number of these issues, but ultimately, as a policymaker here, unless I'm asked to just simply choose among competing ideologies, it seems to me that the proper function of a policymaker is to look at objective information relative to the context in which it's being applied, which is here in Minnesota, and then make a decision based on that. And so I would hope that you would join. I was hoping your answer would be, Representative Mariani, we should definitely look at the tens of millions of dollars we've invested in early childhood in Minnesota, see if it's working in Minnesota, understanding that New Jersey and Mississippi may have problems, but I'm a Minnesota legislator. After all, you're a Minnesota citizen. We're both Minnesota taxpayers. I think we want to know what's happening here on the ground and have a strong assessment of the value of that investment. And so I would hope you would reconsider your position and really encourage this legislature to spend a little resources to ensure that what we're currently investing in the state is in fact effective. And quite frankly, we have lots of folks here from all over the state who have a strong, at least, hunch that these are good investments. And Mr. Chair, I will finally just say that, you know, Minnesota has a huge achievement gap. Absolutely. We have a lot of low-income kids that don't perform well. However, we heard from Head Start that right now we're only reaching 28% of those low-income kids. At the same time, though, Mr. Chair, this state outperforms virtually every other state in the nation on some of the major big academic outcomes: high school graduation rates, college attendance rates, ACT, college readiness measurements. I don't think it's a stretch to at least posit that there might be a connection between the fact that we've been investing, even in our limited way, in the past couple of decades in early childhood, and those kind of outcomes. I do think, though, in all fairness, we ought to study that. We ought to make an objective connection.
Thank you, Representative. And maybe a clarifying question, Ms. Ephraim, because one of your expert opinions that you quoted here said there's a large body of evidence indicating that there's little, if anything, to be gained by exposing middle-class children to early education. And then you also referenced possible fraudulent entry into the program. You said taking away from those who need it. So my question would be, so is it your position that there are a group of kids, whether it's poverty or certain race, would you suggest that there is a group that that Head Start is helping?
Mr. Chairman, what I should have probably said was that if you're going to be spending the money on these programs or on Head Start specifically, then the children that it is that those funds are meant for are the ones that should be getting them. It is still my position that Head Start is not effective, and I don't think we should be increasing our funding for it. But if you are going to do it, you ought to, just from a fiduciary standpoint, make sure that the people that it's the funding is intended for are the ones that get it.
Okay, thank you. And we'll go to Representative Peterson and then Representative Myra.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mariani covered most of what I wanted to say about the assessments, and I would say at best we probably don't know 100% of the things that we want to know about Head Start and its effect on the K-12 success. I guess the only thing, and I believe that you bring a very legitimate question to the table, I really do, and I would hope that you could support that evaluation that Representative Mariani suggests, because I think that maybe we could maybe validate some of your claims that it is ineffective. But I think this body has an obligation, as Representative Mariani said, of representing Minnesota and our constituents and finding out what's actually affecting them. You know, the only thing I would add is just a suggestion, and who am I, but on your list of recommendations, you use some language in here that I think could potentially, I don't know, discredit your position. You know, I'll just quote a few things. This ridiculous assessment gives fuel to the nanny state, quote unquote. This entire warm, fuzzy program. Those types of comments, I think, take away from just, and this is just my opinion, take away from your legitimate point of view, and I do think it is. And that's, I guess, that's all that I want to say.
Thank you. Ms. Ephraim, do you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Peterson, I appreciate your suggestion, and I probably did let emotion get a little bit away with me when I was writing those comments. However, it greatly disturbs me as a mother and a taxpayer that these assessments, and a pediatrician, that these assessments are being used when there's huge questions about their validity to then say, in my opinion, falsely, that 50% of Minnesota children are not ready for kindergarten. And I would add that being ready for kindergarten probably doesn't make a hill of beans of difference as to how these children will do in the long run academically. And the evidence is showing that there is at least evidence of ineffectiveness, if not evidence of both academic and emotional harm of these programs. And that's why I let my emotions get away, because I don't want the children of Minnesota subjected to that, nor the taxpayers to have to pay for that, or parents to lose their autonomy in the raising, education, and medical care of their children.
Thank you. Representative Myra and Quam and Representative Briner will have the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I really appreciate the information that you've put in here, and my personal experience really kind of models what you're saying. I grew up in poverty and in Bolivia, South America, and I started school early because my mom needed to work, actually, to feed the family. And we came to the United States, and I retook first grade. Entering fifth grade, I had nil reading skills. And I knew as a child that there were some things going on. I attributed my difficulties to starting school before I was ready, and also the bilingual thing going on, because in Bolivia, my first language was Spanish, and the school was English-speaking. My family was English-speaking. Coming to Minnesota, Spanish was, I had to eliminate it from my language. I couldn't use it anymore. I'm sad about that. But entering fifth grade, I had nil reading skills. I had a phenomenal teacher who changed my life, and I gained 5 years in fifth grade. That doesn't usually happen. Usually, if you're past, you know, third or fourth grade or have had years of failure, you wouldn't succeed. I ended up home educating my three children, and I had heard about the fade-out issue. I had also heard some compelling information about better learners start learning later on reading. And with my children, particularly my twins, a boy and a girl, I didn't begin reading, teaching them reading until second grade. I delayed it. And they had phenomenal results on their ACT score in reading. And it was interesting for me to see from peers who also home educated their children. Early on, when they were 3 and 4 years old, they learned to quote-unquote read. And yet, in high school, they really did had a hard time keeping up with the amount of reading that was necessary. All three of my children are highest honor students in college. Reading is a huge aspect of it. Anyway, I just want to give that testimony to parental involvement and actually delayed reading. One of the things that just has really come to my mind in all the presentations today is the Head Start program has been around since, I think, 98 or maybe before that. And it's geared for our low-income minority students. And yet, in previous testimony, both in this committee and others, we're hearing about the really poor testing results that we're seeing for our minority and poor students. Can we draw that correlation that they are having? Do we have any studies that would show this child was in an early learning program and these are the results? They graduated or did not graduate. I think that would be really compelling. I would like to know, track individual students as whether they're in Minnesota or elsewhere, but to know this child was in full-day kindergarten, and this is where they're at. They were did not have kindergarten. They had preschool early. I think that would be very, very important to know.
Ms. Ephraim, and briefly, please, we've got two other questions. And
yes, Mr. Chairman,
thank you.
Representative Myra, there aren't always the direct correlational individual studies, but there are the data that I showed you in my presentation are correlational in that, you know, the New Jersey, for instance, court-ordered preschool, then the poor kids on those same, the same population of kids by fourth grade actually have decreased reading scores. So that's, it's a rough correlation. There may be studies out there that have done it more drilled down. I think the Early Childhood Longitudinal Survey may have done that. And there are some of those studies talking about the behavioral problems. And just to let you know, Head Start's been around since 65.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Ephraim, your testimony and testimony from multiple people through several weeks has shown that there's not a clear-cut understanding. I would like to work with Representative Mariani on not just a good study of this effectiveness, but when 50% aren't prepared, then, and that we're testimony that it's more or less uniform across the state, and we have districts and schools within districts that are effective, then we need to understand both preparing better, but also for those students that may not be prepared, what are the best practices to allow them, you know, full opportunity through education. And so you know, I'm willing to work with the other reps and try and do that. But what is your opinion on the biggest things that make up for a possible handicap coming into kindergarten?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kwong, thank you for, and to Representative Mariani as well, your concerns. I would just caution again that the 50% figure is highly questionable because of the standards used and the type of assessment. And I didn't go into detail, but the quotes from the kindergarten readiness assessment trainer say a lot about the validity of that assessment. And these, again, readiness doesn't necessarily correlate with long-term academic performance. So that's one thing. But to answer your second question, by far and away, the thing that is most important in improving the achievement gap is two-parent families. And you can't legislate that, but you can do policy that promotes it and certainly doesn't inhibit it. And not only does it deal with the, and Dr. Jane's study shows that if a high school student, minority high school student, is from a two-parent family and has religious involvement, there is no achievement gap. Now, that is the only thing I have ever read, ever, anywhere, that shows that the achievement gap is erased, not just diminished, erased. So, to me, by far and away, that is the policy that you really need to work on, not the stuff in early childhood, which I think is of dubious effectiveness and may actually cause harm.
Thank you. And Representative Breiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to be respectful here. There's been different points of view advanced, and I think this there are some complicated issues around research here, but you know, I was a stay-at-home mom because I valued the time necessary to be with my children, and I think that gave them a leg up in a lot of ways. But that opportunity isn't available for all of our children. And I think where I want to go here is I've been involved in educational issues for 20 to 30 years in a range of ways. And the research that Dr. Ephraim uses here isn't research that I've heard objectively vetted in enough venues to convince me that it balances the research we heard earlier from the early childhood and the Head Start people. Now, maybe there are outside objective researchers who might vet it that way, but until I see that, I'm reluctant to put it on the same plane. But the one thing I want to do is simply speak on behalf of research related to the benefit of all-day kindergarten. I served 12 years on my own local school board, and I was a part of a long-time move to achieve funding for all-day kindergarten. We funded it locally out of a levy. We've had it a number of years, and we do have some longitudinal data of the effectiveness of all-day kindergarten for all of our students, but most especially for our at-most risk students, moving from, and the testing measure here is what's known as DIBLES, Dynamic Indicators of Basic Early Literacy, Early Learning Skills, from at the beginning of kindergarten to the end of kindergarten, a move from 50% preparation readiness to 90% preparation. That's one body of data I'm familiar with and I trust because I've seen it vetted in a number of venues. So all I'm saying is we need to apply high standards to the research we bring to the table in evaluating the programs that we make policy decisions on.
Dr. Ephraim, and I need to apologize to you. I did not see your title before, and I apologize for I should have been addressing you as that. So, Dr. Ephraim, your final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Breinert, I totally agree with you that the research needs to be strong and good, and that is why I included the sources for everything that I said. And these are not fly by night. They are often the same sources that are used by proponents of early childhood or all-day kindergarten. And it's very important that and I gave you direct quotes, I didn't give you my opinion. We need to look at the whole picture, and my concern, especially when we're talking about spending $500 million for all-day kindergarten or $500 million for preschool in general, is to really look at this. And yes, there are studies that show improvement in full-day kindergarten compared to half-day kindergarten, but there are studies, including ones that I showed by the RAND Corporation, which is not a conservative think tank, that actually show academic harm. And you have to balance that. You do have to look at that before you make such a big decision. And that's what I'm trying to bring forward. So I appreciate your willingness to look at that research. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ephraim, for your presentation, and thank you to all the members for your questions and attention today. Is there anything else for the committee? If not, this meeting is adjourned.